This is Jason Miller. On this episode of Jazzcast from the Vault, jazz artist interviews from the KVOU archives, my 2006 interview with author Ashley Kahn about his book, Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. Today on Afternoon Jazz, it's my pleasure to welcome my guest, author Ashley Kahn. We're going to be talking about his book, Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece, issued in 2000 on DaCapo Press. Mr. Kahn is also a journalist and editor who has contributed articles to the New York Times, Rolling Stone, and other publications. The first thing I'd like to do is welcome you to the Afternoon Jazz Show here on KVLU Radio.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And it's coming up on the 50th anniversary of Kind of Blue, and I guess this is going to be kind of possibly a busy year for you.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of anniversaries happening this year. You know, there's the 70th anniversary of Blue Note Records.
Great.
There's the 50th anniversary, as you said, of Kind of Blue, but also some other great albums like Giant Steps and Ornette Coleman's, you know, breakthrough album, The Shape of Jazz to Come.
Wow.
All that was happening in 59. It was an incredible year. Also, Dave Brubeck's Time Out, which had, you know, the huge hit Take Five on it.
Wow, it was definitely a significant time. And I guess the first question I'd like to ask for you is, coming back to Kind of Blue, our focus for the interview, what's the overall significance of this particular recording that has happened in the last 50 years since it's been released?
Well, Kind of Blue serves a lot of purposes as far as, represents a lot of things to different people. It's the most popular, best-selling album of the classic jazz period. Which says a lot, because, you know, there's the saying that if you have one jazz album in your collection, that album's going to be Kind of Blue. And it is a doorway. It's a doorway for many people who got into jazz, because it is so accessible on one level, but it is so deep and so artistic. You know, it's truly a masterpiece on another level. And I don't use the word masterpiece loosely, but one definition of a masterpiece is that as one grows, one interacts with a piece of art in a different sort of way as they get older and more mature. And if a canvas or a great theatrical work or a great movie stands up to that test, that you get to see more and more and it speaks to you more and more over time, Kind of Blue definitely fits into that category.
Well, how did you come across the album the first time?
You know, I'm almost like a poster boy for that kind of thing. I was in it was the mid-70s. I was a, rock and roll teenager. I was getting into punk. I was all about, Bruce Springsteen and Bob Marley. And the guy who turned me on to Bob Marley and the Talking Heads and groups like that back then was over at my place for a change, and he went over to my father's record collection, which I hardly even approached. That was dad's stuff. And he pulled out Kind of Blue, and he said, "Oh, you know what? This is a classic." And, it took a friend's kind of like introduction to make me be okay about one of my father's albums, and to kind of like see that I was starting to look at music in a very limited way.
Right.
I was all about post-Woodstock rock and roll and nothing else. And I made a decision then. I mean, after listening to the album a lot, with a lot of clicks and pops and whatnot, because obviously my father had listened to it a lot too, I made a decision that I was definitely not going to put up walls to any type of music. And that was the lesson I learned from Kind of Blue. And, of course, it did open the doorway for me, because after that, I start to look at who's on the album.
Right.
John Coltrane,
sure.
Bill Evans, Cannonball Adderley. So you start to explore those guys. And, of course, Miles Davis's career is a whole other story unto itself.
And I guess the next question I'd like to ask is, what do you think is something that still is that the aspect of it? It's just such great music that it blurs the lines between different genres for people that maybe didn't listen to jazz at all? Because you usually hear stories about people coming to Miles Davis's electric music, because of the connection to like rock and stuff like that.
Sure. What you're saying about the electric side of Miles, I think it's very specific to a time period, and that especially to younger listeners who were listening in the 70s, and they were picking up albums like Bitches Brew or On the Corner or Live Evil, there was no, like, preconditioned idea that this is not jazz, that jazz should sound like Benny Goodman or Duke Ellington or you know, Art Blakey or Horace Silver or whatever. And those years, younger years, are always more open and flexible. And over time, you know, you kind of get used to what you like, you know. And it's just a natural way, you know, that listening audiences move. And with Miles, I think that, what he did with Kind of Blue is something that negates the idea of time periods and whatnot. It transcends its time period. When people nowadays listen to that music, they don't go, oh, that's 50s jazz.
It's timeless.
Though it is 50s jazz, it does have this timeless quality.
Could have been recorded yesterday.
Yeah.
I mean, you can probably surprise people by playing it that aren't akin to jazz, and they say, well, when did that come out? That come out last year?
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea that Miles put behind it of trying to blend the sort of elegance and sophistication and moodiness of classical music, of classical modes, of the type of scales and whatnot that contemporary classical composers were using at that time, with the swing and the groove of the blues and jazz, is something that a lot of people have tried to do. But something happened that was very special in this recording. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that it was first take, that a lot of the material, most of the material, had not been seen before, been tried out before by the Sidemen. And then, of course, look at who the Sidemen were.
You do such a wonderful job in your book building up to how this all coalesced and took place. And I wonder if you could just summarize where Miles Davis's career was at this point in time and how that coincided with him discovering the modal concept that he used in this album.
Well, Miles was always an explorer and always an experimenter, you know, intrepid musician. By 1959, his career, he had been in New York for a good 15, 16 years. He was in his early 30s, he was 33, just married, had this ace backup band, John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, you know, Bill Evans. Wynton Kelly had replaced Bill Evans by that point, by the time of the recording, but Bill and him had been working on a lot of the music together, so Bill came back. And Jimmy Cobb on drums, Mr. 4-4, and Paul Chambers on bass. And incredible group. And he's the type of leader who gives them a lot of room to express themselves. He you know, he's not like one of those big band leaders where everything's on the chart and play this and then you get your eight bars to solo and then come back. But he wants individual expression and he wants individual input in a lot of these recordings. And if you listen to the master, you know, session tapes for Kind of Blue, you hear a lot of stuff coming together in the studio. He's using the studio as a sort of workshop place. And that sort of freedom to mold it as it's being recorded is something that he allowed himself. I mean, that became more his modus operandi over, you know, in his career. But back to your question, where he was in 1959 was, you know, he was more than just a jazz leader. He was a music leader, and he was a cultural star. You know, for Black America looked upon him in the same way that they looked at Sidney Poitier or Joe Robinson or, you know, Jackie Robinson, cultural heroes of the day. He was being marketed and publicized, promoted by the number one record company, the sort of Tiffany of record companies of that time, Columbia Records, as a music star. Not just a jazz star, but a music star. So he was, the same people who were promoting Doris Day and Johnny Mathis were also promoting Miles Davis. So all eyes were on him. Mainstream America had accepted him. And as a result, Kind of Blue already was going to be kind of propelled into, you know, mainstream homes as well as those jazz fans. he had crossed over, and yet he remained so artistically revered at the same time. He was able to his feet in both worlds.
I found it very interesting when I was reading how you talk about how, you know, some of us just think the modal thing happened with Kind of Blue, but Miles Davis had been exploring with this, with particular songs, before he actually did the whole album like that.
Yeah, I mean, the crazy thing is that the 50s was such a general time, you know, for experimenting and trying to move the music forward. If you really wanted to talk about jazz in the 50s, it, you know, and sort of like find it, description for what was happening, I would say that it is, you know, the jazz world was trying to figure out what to do with this new language of jazz that Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie had brought into being, you know, popularly known as bebop, generally known now just as modern jazz. But it's like, okay, we have a new way of playing with new freedoms, rhythm and harmony, you know, crazy new melodies, very hip melodies. What do we do with it? And different people had different answers. And part of it, you know, was definitely to try and bring in influences from outside, whether it was folk music, foreign music, classical music. And one of the classical music ideas that Bill Evans was turning Miles onto, as well as George Russell, you know, his great composer and arranger, was the idea of Russian contemporary music, French contemporary music, you know, or 20th century classical music.
Right.
And a lot of that music, the harmony, the idea of staying on one scale or one tonic, you know, for a long time, is kind of antithetical to what bebop was about. Bebop was about fast-moving harmony, moving from one chord to another to another. Or, you know, you can call it scale, or you can call it a mode, hence modal jazz.
Right.
And the idea of hanging on to a mode was something that Miles was experimenting with, and that's really, it doesn't fully explain the mastery of Kind of Blue. It's a device that he used. It was a doorway that he went through to try and push the idea of more individual expression. He wanted to get away from the cliches of bebop. In an interview that Miles did in 1958, like, you know, when he was thinking about the ideas that would come out in Kind of Blue, he described the music as being cluttered. The music scene and the music that was happening in the late 50s was cluttered, meaning that, you know, these were older ideas. He wanted fresh, he wanted new. And so he used all of these devices. But there's no way on paper, you know, just because you put it on paper, that you can say, oh, definitely this idea is going to generate a great recording. So call it modal jazz, but it just happened to be a device that Miles was using.
And used it to great success.
Exactly.
Great success.
Who could have predicted it?
Yeah, yeah.
Talked to Jimmy Cobb about the session. For him, it was another day at work.
Yeah, I found that interesting. I guess he was a quite valuable source in speaking about the album, though. In certain instances, how there were certain things I'm sure that he surprised you with.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, in doing the book, I had to do some digging because Jimmy's the only surviving member of that band. And sad as that is, there were some interviews that Cannonball did and that Bill Evans did where they talked about Kind of Blue. Miles Davis, on the other hand, there was interviews where he would talk about Kind of Blue, but what he would say is, listen, I've moved on. I want you to like me for what I'm performing now. Kind of Blue, so what? It had its day, you know, but I'm here now. That's back there.
I guess that's one of the things about his success. He was always in the present. He was always moving forward.
Exactly.
What were some of the surprises and you came across in researching this book? Because you had a lot of behind the scenes, I guess I could say, privileges to the access to the tapes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the biggest surprise was just being able to sit down with the actual tapes, the same reel-to-reel tapes that were passing over the recording head way back in March and April of 1959, hearing how at ease the guys were in the studio, how humorous and funny Miles was when he was in his elements. I mean, you know, Miles has a reputation for turning his back on the audience and being this sort of seething personality who was always ready to explode or whatever. And as, I mean, granted, he did not suffer fools gladly. He did have a short fuse. But for the most part, he loved what he did. And when he was in the middle of doing it, it's like witnessing, like I said, a man in his element, a man in his world. It was, they were joking, it was easy, it was, you know, it was not, it didn't sound like work at all.
And so I guess the studio atmosphere was pretty conducive to this?
Oh, yeah. Man, they were cracking jokes, and, you know, Miles was, like, teasing his producer, Irving Townsend, you know. The other stuff that was surprising was how much Bill Evans brought to, right. You know, I mean, he does deserve compositional credit just by the, you know, the way that he was helping to shape and structure, especially two of the tunes, Blue and Green and Flamenco Sketches.
And it's just such beautiful music. And so Bill Evans, you said, also had an aspect of Flamenco Sketches as well in the composition of that?
Yeah, Flamenco Sketches, which is basically, you know, if you want to talk about the modal jazz idea on Kind of Blue, Flamenco Sketches is the purest and best example of that. Because what it is an ostinato bass pattern that he had actually used before on one of his recordings, Bill Evans' Peace. And he had improvised that just, you know, while he was in the studio. And he brought that idea, but he said, okay, now let's let the soloist solo through five different modes, five different scales that he chose. Those scales were his choosing. And the idea of that ostinato pattern, the bass pattern that sort of holds it in place, was his idea too. So definitely he deserves compositional credit for that. But, you know, back in the day, you know, they were coming, jazz was moving forward, but it was also coming out of a past that was much about band leaders. And band leaders got credit for anything that was done within the auspices of their groups. So if you know, when the album came out, it said Miles Davis, you know, got compositional credit for each of the tunes, kind of stuck with that.
Another beautiful piece, Flamenco Sketches, I had listened to that, played it on the show when I did a little tease for this a while back, and it's such a, just a, you can just sit and just contemplate and dream to that song. It's such a beautiful piece of music, my goodness.
I mean, what the soloists do with that thing. I think what's really incredible is that Miles' idea of clear, you know, I don't want to say simplifying the music. It's more like he was clearing it. You think of it as a piece of glass and you just want it to be able to, like, look through it better. That's what he was doing with the music. And what you see through that glass is the individual musical personalities of these unbelievable soloists. What Coltrane does with those five scales and the amount of sort of the emotional range that he covers is just, it's one of my favorite Coltrane solos of all time. Yeah. And there's a lot of great Coltrane solos,
exactly.
You know, out there.
What a beautiful piece. And it's not one that's covered as often as some of the other pieces from the album.
Yeah, so. Well, it's not really recognizable except for that, you know, ostinato thing. And so it doesn't have that hip, instantly recognizable melody that So What does.
Sure.
You play the So What melody for anyone, and they'll recognize it. Or if it's for the first time, they'll be whistling it as they walk out of the club or out of wherever they are hearing it from. But Flamenco Sketches, there isn't, like, a recognizable melody at the top. Okay. Hence why it's so purely modal.
Talk about So What. Now, this was... the lead track, appropriately enough. What order was this recorded in? Was this something that Miles had right away, or did this one develop?
Well, in the studio, it was actually the second tune that they did that okay. on the first session for Kind of Blue. But, you know, it has two parts. It has that introduction, and then it has the sort of the tune itself, which bounces between two different modes. It's basically about the Dorian scale. But again, you know, I don't want to get lost in talking about the technical aspect, because the emotional aspect and that feeling of the blues, hence Kind of Blue, you know, that's in So What, is just so deep and so elemental. That clarity in the music that I was talking about before, you can hear the blues roots in jazz so clearly through this album, and you can hear how important the blues is to the jazz genre and how important the blues was to Miles Davis. Miles dug him some blues, and it never left his music, and that you got to love him for, too. Could there be a better or a more famous opening track, opening sound to an album than So What? That sort of dreamy rubato bass piano duet that is so recognizable. And then the way that it leads to the bass line introducing the melody, everybody knows that.
The next question I wanted to ask is just a little bit about some of the, I guess you could say, kind of myths behind the album of the one-take idea and things like that. Were they actually all one-takes, or were there just a few takes, or did they, you know, how did that kind of come together as far as what was chosen to be on the album, what songs, what takes, etc.?
The truth is, there 4 out of 5 of the tunes on Kind of Blue are the first complete takes. There are a few sort of false starts or breakdowns, as they call them, you know, where something went wrong in the structure, in the form of the piece, and Miles would call it off. That happened like 2-3 times. But you've got to understand that the level of efficiency, you know, as far as being these musicians were so good at what they did, they were so good at their craft, that once they knew that this was a slightly different structure, let's say Freddie Freeloader, it's a blues, but it's a kind of blues, you know, hence, once again, we come back to the title. But it's more like a 24-bar blues. And once again, I don't want to get too stuck in the, you know, explaining the technical aspect, but these cats were going to get it down the first time. What was most important about the first take thing for Miles was that the solos, he didn't want to go over it again. He was so totally of the idea that first thought is the best thought. And, you know, you listen to, like I said, Coltrane's solo and Flamenco Sketches, or, oh my God, Cannonball Adderley's solo on All Blues. Rock guitarists quote that, from especially the first couple of bars. Yeah. It's so well known that you could say that about Kind of Blue in general. The solos are as well known now as the tunes themselves are.
Now, Miles did just bring them sketches of these songs. Now, him and Bill Evans had talked before, right, about...
Yeah.
Because I like how you said how Miles Davis basically gave Bill Evans a chord structure and said, see what you can do with this, and then Blue and Green was birthed from that.
Right.
One thing that I ran across, I'd never known until I'd got the one of the many reissues that they had in the late 90s from Columbia, was the speed was off.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they always say that every masterpiece has a slight flaw in it, whether it's like a cracked part of a vase or a canvas that has something wrong with it. And the A side of the album, I'm talking back in vinyl days now, the first three tunes, So What, Freddie Freeloader, and Blue and Green, were done at the tape that it was recorded on. All three tunes, by the way, were recorded during the first session. And during that first session, one of the tape machines was slightly off and was recording slow, so that when you played it back, it was a quarter tone off.
Right.
And so musicians with very good pitch, especially pitch-perfect musicians, would want to, like, replicate the sound and play along with it, and they would go, something's wrong. And this was, like, 25, 30 years. It was out in the world, selling incredibly, becoming part of the lingua franca of the jazz world, and the music world in general, and nobody really, you know, had pinpointed why that was, until those late 90s reissues.
It has been reissued many a times, correct? And there's even a 50th anniversary edition.
Absolutely. There's a box set that came out. I actually have an essay in there where I talk about, you know, what was happening in the studio and what you can tell from listening to those session tapes.
I'd like to go ahead and also talk about the book itself here, Kind of Blue, The Making of Miles Davis Masterpiece. So it's a wonderful book, and really enjoyed it. And I want to tell the listeners that it's just all the information, and you've got great interviews and great research into this masterpiece.
Thank you.
And, what are there any other events or different things that are happening with the 50th anniversary? You're doing some lectures and other things concerning this
well, anniversary? I always do that. I've found that, you know, being able to speak about Kind of Blue as a doorway, and I keep coming back to that term, but as a sort of portal to understanding jazz or a way of talking about jazz, is something that I love to do, because, you know, I think that different people process music in different ways, and it's all equally valid. So talking about Kind of Blue on a musician's level, on a musicianship level, talking about the musical devices and the technical aspect of it, but then also talking about how the recording came together, the social aspects and cultural aspects of 1959, where Miles was with his career, where the jazz world was in general, and where jazz fit into American culture is also important. And I love being able to talk and bring all of that together, much like I did in the book. But ultimately, Jason, I think that the book, the talking about it, etc., is meant to enhance the listening.
Yes.
And it should all go back to one place, which is to the music itself.
Ashley, thank you so much for talking to me this afternoon on the program. And Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece is the book. It's a wonderful read about this amazing, legendary jazz recording. And happy 50th.
Yes, indeed.
For the recording. And again, thank you for talking to me here on Afternoon
Jazz.
It's
been a pleasure. Look forward to the next time.
Awesome. Thank you. This episode featured my 2006 interview with author Ashley Kahn about his book Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece. You can find out more about KVLU by visiting our website, kvlu.org.